You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Well, hello, Christina.
Well, hello, Mike.
Thanks for joining the Business of Pharmacy podcast. I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and you're way over in Vancouver, Canada, yeah. Way on the West Coast. And I was going to sit here and laugh at you for being so far north and having such terrible weather. But before I did that, I looked online and I saw that you've got great weather out there year round.
Yeah, this is the most beautiful city. I would say this is the most beautiful city in all of Canada, really.
No. Oh.
And I've lived back east most for half of my life, and you know, I must say, moving out here has been a blessing. It's like paradise out here.
That's great. It looks beautiful. Well, Christina, introduce yourself and tell why you and I are talking today, just outside of the range of just because you're a pharmacist, but what actually got us talking on this show together.
Sure. Well, I've been practicing pharmacy for, I would say, almost 30 years now. I absolutely love my profession. And so, yeah, a bachelor's in pharmacy practice, but I also went ahead and did a master's in bioethics. And so you've asked me to talk a little bit about why a pharmacist would want to do a master's in bioethics.
Yeah, because I think of bioethics, and I'm always thinking of things nowadays like test tube babies and stem cell research and things like that. But what got you into the interest in bioethics being a pharmacist?
Well, first, I'd like to start off with, because most people maybe don't know what bioethics entails exactly, or what it is. So there's actually, and I don't usually use Wikipedia, but there's a really good definition, so I'm going to use it. So bioethics is essentially the study of ethical issues that emerge from advances in biology and medicine. And it's concerned with ethical questions that arise in the relationships among life sciences. So biotech, medicine and medical ethics, politics, law, as well as theology and philosophy. Why would a pharmacist like myself want to get into the study of bioethics? So for me, the idea came as a result of my passion for wanting to help others understand the reasons why sometimes a pharmacist or other healthcare professional might not be able to participate in the provision of some service or the dispensing of some drug. And this came as a result of policy changes that took place, at least in Canada, and I think in the U.S. as well, in the mid-1990s, we had changes in our codes of ethics that sought to change from a virtues-focused ethics to a patient-centered, outcomes-focused. So in other words, going from what you might call a deontological ethics to a consequentialist ethics. Now, I know that those are big words and most people don't understand what they mean, but essentially a deontological ethics is a system that judges whether an action is right or wrong based on a moral code and not just based on the consequences of the action or the outcomes. A utilitarian or consequential ethics states that any course of action can be taken as long as the outcome is what you want, or as long as the outcome is good, in your mind is good.
So essentially that's the ends don't always justify the means. Is that right? So you might have an end you're looking for, but that doesn't mean that you can necessarily take every step that you want to get there if it's crossing certain ethical lines.
You know, as an example, there might be something I don't particularly want or like to dispense, but I hesitate. I wouldn't say to the patient, well, I don't have it
if
I have it.
Gotcha. Right?
So that wouldn't be just to do that. So, and so these changes in the codes of ethics, at first glance, I didn't pay much attention. It was 1997 when I moved to BC from back east, from Toronto, Montreal area. And I didn't pay much attention until there was a product that came on the market. I don't know if you remember, the morning after pill was previously dispensed as an overdose of birth control pills, and then now it was patented and marketed as a product called Preven at the time.
Sure.
And so all of a sudden I re-looked at my code and I said, uh-oh, there's stuff in the new code that is going to be problematic for me, because essentially it's saying that a pharmacist can have freedom of conscience and religion, but they must dispense if no one else is available to do so, and things like that. So it was clear that there was no real respect for freedom of conscience. And when I say, I want to just backtrack it a little. Conscience, because many people think of conscience and they go, oh my God, conscience means it's a little voice in you that tells you you're guilty of something.
Yeah.
And that's not what conscience is. Conscience essentially needs to be, everyone has one. You can be religious or non-religious, doesn't matter. Everyone has a conscience, the ability to a dialogue to with one's self and examine one's course of action. So you're not judging the person in front of you or their acts. You're judging your own acts.
Sure.
And the conscience needs to be formed, and it doesn't necessarily have to be formed by a religious tradition. It can be formed by you know, the experience of our elders, you know, of our parents, our forefathers,
yes.
Right? By reading good classics, by speaking to leaders in our community, there's many ways of forming that
sure.
conscience, right? And so that's important to get out there.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So the code of ethics that you came across in Canada, were they saying that you had a obligation to transfer that to another pharmacy, or were they saying that your pharmacy had an obligation to dispense that?
It was that you had to refer. There was the requirement of referring. So if you, for example, would not dispense it yourself, then you had to refer to another person. Now, what people don't realize is referral is akin to doing it yourself.
It would be if somebody came to you and said, could you please give me your gun
right.
because I want to kill my neighbor? And we say, I don't do that, but the law is telling me that I have to tell you that I know there's a gun in the garage of the neighbors next door that's loaded.
So you would still be guilty of participating in some way, right? And you would still be...
It sure seems that way to me.
I think in a court of law, you would still be found guilty. And the Nuremberg trials, nobody likes to think about that, but
yeah.
There were doctors who facilitated the execution of patients, and just by giving the drug out, or by even if they weren't infusing it themselves, right?
Yeah, right.
So there's many situations in the world out there, and I use the word secular, but I mean, we live in the secular world, so we are dealing with
sure.
secular topics right now. But yeah, so what I did essentially when I did my degree in bioethics is I wanted to study all the codes of ethics across the country to see how they differed in their stance on freedom of conscience. And
sure.
So what I did is, yeah, essentially I found that there were 5 out of the 10 provinces that said, yes, you must refer. Any referral had to ensure that there was minimal inconvenience to the patient. So that would mean that's very subjective, right? So if you had
gotcha.
To go down the street, that might be good. But if the patient was in a wheelchair and they had to go down the street, that might
gotcha.
Be really inconvenient, right?
Yes.
So, of course, since that was in 2009, and since then, a lot of things have happened that I can talk a little bit about. And there have been extensive changes to all the codes for the better, I have to say. So since the decriminalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide, which in my mind are even more serious than Preven, there have been extensive revampings of all the codes of ethics across the country. Some of them still require referral. Some of them still, there's 2 of the provinces that still require referral specifically for what they call medical assistance in dying to the patient. So referral must be made to the patient. A couple of the other provinces are just referring the doctor to another pharmacy. So that can be problematic. And you think about it, I have a friend as an example, my friend Armando. That's not really his real name, but anyway, my friend
sure.
Armando. We talked about this. You know, he says, look, I'm not against assisted suicide, but I worked at a pharmacy and I was And they were going to participate in provision of the drugs. And he says, but I couldn't do it myself. You know, I'm not against it, but I can't do it. So a proper conscience clause should protect the integrity of a pharmacist in that situation. And so I want to backtrack a little bit and go back to why I would have gone to the University of Navarre in 2005 to start a degree in bioethics. And
yeah.
So all of this stuff was happening. Codes of ethics were changing. There was this creeping in of policies that I couldn't agree with. And I was speaking out in the media. I was interviewed on radio, television here in Canada on these issues. And I saw that sometimes reporters, journalists would, with all good intention, would get my words or my meaning wrong. And so I started thinking, you know, I've got to start writing myself. So I started writing for the paper myself. And but I needed to find a better way of explaining things because I was realizing I wasn't reaching people properly. I wasn't – it seemed like my words were escaping. They were sounding judgmental. And that was
–
it's not the intent of an objection to something.
Sure.
It's not to judge the person that wants the service. In fact, they can still get it elsewhere, right? It's not to trump anybody's rights, but it's to help people understand that you can't force someone to do something they believe is wrong. No, you can always do you cannot always do all the good you'd like, but you cannot force someone to do something they believe is wrong. Because you pervert their conscience, you pervert that person, right?
Sure.
So then in 2005, when I was in the middle of all of this, as well as lobbying my college for many years to change that code of ethics, it wasn't just myself. There was a group of us pharmacists who were quite concerned. And every year we presented at the College of Pharmacists AGM trying to change that code, you know, change it so that it would be more respectful to freedom of conscience and religion. And a few successes here and there, but not much happening. So in 2005, I heard of a new program at the University of Navarre, of all places in Spain, which is my country of origin. I was born in Madrid. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So I thought, hey, not because it was in Spain, which is a beautiful country, but I thought, hey, this is an opportunity because it so happened that one of the professors at this of this program is a pharmacist, Jose Lopez Guzman. He's a pharmacist who has written books, one of them on conscientious objection in pharmacy practice in 1997, another one on the morning after pill, a juridical. I have the title here somewhere, but anyway, it doesn't matter. The morning after pill, pharmaceutical aspects, ethical and juridical aspects of it. So that was an amazing, I thought this guy is someone I have to meet. I read his books, of course, in Spanish, which was a little bit challenging for me. And I thought, okay, I've got to meet this guy. And so this was a perfect opportunity. I went to Spain. It was a course that was meant for professionals already, so people who were working in their field. And I continued to work full time and had to travel to Spain at least 3 times a year and stay there for about 10 days at a time.
Is that right?
And, it allowed me to meet people from all over the world, the Spanish-speaking world, of course, people who, I was lucky enough to be able to present my paper in English, the paper that I wrote, which, again, explored the codes of ethics across the country, across Canada. Right? And then in 2009, I published a paper in the Annals of Pharmacology. I actually sent out a paper to many, many journals, and this one really liked the idea of the topic of the title of the of the article is The Hijacking of Moral Conscience, A Canadian Perspective. And it was a peer-reviewed journal, so it was interesting to see the back and forth that goes on.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It was a lot of fun to work with the Annals of Pharmacotherapy. And but I have to admit that since 2009, that since that publication, I haven't, you know, I've been busy working full time, so I haven't had a lot of time to write more articles except for stuff I do on my blog online, and that's about it.
Yeah, I know what you mean by wanting to have something written versus interviews, because sometimes even not intentionally they can chop off things that just change the meaning of your intents.
Well, actually, I have to tell you about one interview I had. It was, I mean, I had a few live interviews, which is kind of fun because, you know, they're not going to cut you off.
Yeah, right.
Or change your words. But I had one interview that was for the CBC, and it was recorded. It was televised. And so I brought a tape recorder to the interview, and I said to the journalist, I said, you know, do you mind if I tape this? You know?
Oh, yeah.
And she was taken a little bit aback because I know what they do.
Right.
They just chop it off, right? And they make you look really mean. Or I had one interview where they made me look really mean. And I thought, oh, my goodness.
I had one time where the paper interviewed me, and this was on some other subject, but it was on insurance for the elderly. And some of the elderly, like my grandma, she didn't need any handouts because she had plenty of money from her husband passed away and things like that. And then I said, well, a lot of people do need that help, but it came out where they cut off the part, you know, they cut off the part about a lot of people need the help, and they just left in that, you know, Mike doesn't like old people kind of stuff. So, so you do have to be careful.
So,
Christina, that was in 2009. And so, so here 10 years later, then, how has things impacted you, either pro or con, since that time?
In 2012 is when youth and assisted suicide and euthanasia were decriminalized in Canada. And so all of a sudden people were like, you know, we didn't think this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And things started to change from that point on. And I was also able to get onto the college's ethics advisory committee. I was appointed to the committee in 2000. I get the dates wrong. I think it was 2006 or 2005. Anyway, somewhere around there. I was on that committee for some years. And when decriminalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia came along, we were able to at least make a few changes that would allow for freedom of conscience. And we still need to ensure the patient can get what they want, but there's not that the wording has been changed so that there's a little bit more leeway there. I mean, you know, when you think about it, one of the things that always strikes me is that if you think about any other service in your pharmacy, if you're a pharmacy owner or, you know, you can, there's certain things you just don't carry, you know. You may not have a certain type of walker or type of cane or, and for those things, there is no need to refer. I mean, the patient is really inconvenienced, very highly inconvenienced sometimes. And yet there's no policy that says you must refer. But when it comes to the conscience of the pharmacist in the meatier areas of life, it's striking that then we are seen as the power imbalance is quoted. Essentially, all of a sudden, things are turned around. They said, well, no, for those things that are, you know, you're just being squeamish, you should refer. You should refer them. In fact, even in Quebec, you must not only do you have to refer, but you must call the pharmacy that you're referring the patient to, ensure that they're going to provide it, and then call the patient at home to ensure they've gotten whatever they wanted. So, which again, it's like doing it yourself, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting because if you are a pharmacy owner and you decide not to carry a walker, let's say, as your example was, you you might not be carrying it for a lot of reasons. You might not be carrying it because it's just a pain in the behind to get the walker in and to put it together with the tools and screws, or it takes up too much room, or there's a lot of things you don't like, but none of them go against your conscience. There's just things that are kind of like, they're kind of like, you might just be lazy. Maybe you don't want to sell that walker. But no one says to you, if you're lazy, if you're doing this, then you've got to have someone else do it. And you're like, you know, why? But now when it's something even greater, when it's your own conscience, and that's arguable, or not even arguably, that's a bigger issue than laziness or maybe having space or something. But then all of a sudden, you've got to be complicit with it. It seems backwards. It seems like they would say, you know, if it's just because you're lazy, then come on, let's help them out and help them find it, you know. But it's opposite, because it's you're against it. Now help them find it. So it seems backwards to me.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. I know where it stems from. Again, it's this the notion of power imbalance, which again, it's a very socialist kind of ideological stance. Mm-hmm. If you go to some of the bioethical principles of, in 1979, Beauchamp and Childress, who were some of the first bioethicists to write on this topic, they came up with some basic bioethical principles. And so there's the principle of non-maleficence, which you shall do no wrong, the principle of beneficence, which you shall do good, the principle of justice, and the principle of autonomy. So essentially what the new codes of ethics have done is put the principle of autonomy, so patient autonomy, over and above that of thou shalt do no harm or thou shalt do good. And so autonomy is actually been twisted. You can talk of the whole ideology of choice as an example. You know, it's been twisted. I understand that patients, of course, they have to have the ability to make their own decisions. And we're not trying to take that away from patients.
Yeah.
But to say that autonomy comes over above non-maleficence would be ridiculous. If you think about, for example, a drug addict comes in and he wants to get his stuff, you know, and you as a pharmacist, well, you don't want to do harm. So you're going to practice non-maleficence and you're going to practice beneficence, and you're not going to give out the drugs to this drug addict, right? Or you can think of many other cases where the principle of autonomy, patient autonomy, wouldn't be put over and above that of the others. And your example of, you know, products out there that, you know, going back to the fact that we can refuse to give out a certain service, like for example, right now we have expanded scope of practice. That's another area. You know, there's, because of our expanded scope, there's more reason to ensure that we have freedom of conscience, because there's going to be more dilemmas that come up.
And
not all pharmacists are doing injections. Not all pharmacists are doing med reviews. I mean, is
exactly
it going to be mandated? So are you going to mandate that? Actually, some corporations are, as you know, mandating. Some corporations, pharmacy corporations, have quotas that so that you get poor pharmacists who, you know, in order to meet the quota, they have to do things that are not necessarily ethical, like making the patient sign that they did a med review, which they never did. So anyway, we can go on and on about, there's a lot of other ethical issues, obviously, than just the ones I've brought up. When I spoke about the decriminalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide, I think I said 2012. It was actually 2016 is when assisted suicide and euthanasia were decriminalized in Canada. And as a result of this, people were all of a sudden, you know, the alarm bells were going off, and things I had been saying to the ethics committee and to the colleges that would come down the pike. I was warning that this might happen, and they said, nah, this will never happen in Canada. you know, all of a sudden it came true. And there's a lot of pharmacists out there who, you know, maybe they're not necessarily against it, but they certainly don't want to be the ones participating in it. So all of a sudden, you know, they're implicated. I mean, every province is different. So in British Columbia, you still have to, I mean, the doctor, him or herself, has to contact the pharmacy directly. So it's not the patient that will walk in with a prescription. But I can see it where, you know, there may be some pharmacies who will have kits available, right? So this is your euthanasia kit. And for those patients who are going to be doing it themselves at home, that kit could potentially be sitting there, you know, and you could never know who took it or who, or if that patient was forced to take the drugs, right? So you as a pharmacist, maybe you're not necessarily against the concept of assisted suicide or euthanasia, but you wonder, well, there's other ethical issues that will crop up in your mind, like who, will someone force this patient to take these drugs, or will they feel coerced because they feel like they're a burden to their family?
As the many, many doctors that took place in the you know, atrocities of World War II and so on under Hitler, you think you're far away from that, but society and laws can gradually march up, and before you know it, you're all in this together.
Yes, and the thing is that the more we, the longer this is in place, the more it becomes normalized. So
exactly.
And at a given moment, what ends up happening too is, I mean, I've heard pharmacists speak who have participated. They feel horrible about it, but they almost feel as if they've done something heroic. And it's a little bit of a twisted way of thinking. There's something that there's an ethicist, Canadian ethicist who's now living in Australia, who, actually, she's originally from Australia, but was in Canada for many years, Margaret Somerville, who spoke about the yuck factor. And she said that there's a certain yuck factor that we all have inside ourselves. And when you think about something you with your rational mind, you know, and you say, I have this horrible feeling or horrible, there's something... It doesn't seem right. It doesn't sit right with me.
Right.
You have to listen to that gut instinct because it's there for a reason, this yuck factor.
Right.
So these pharmacists who have that yuck factor and yet they feel that, you know, because this is now legal, therefore it's good because it's legal. Sometimes people equate legality with goodness and with right. You know, something that's legal is right.
You know, an example of that, of course, is, you know, slavery in the U.S. before the Civil War is legal, but it wasn't right.
Yeah. So, and there were people with a conscience who knew that or who felt that way, but because it was so tied into the economy, they were unable to rid themselves of slavery for so many years, right? With, and of course, other reasons. You know, you can see this creeping in and saying, well, is this going to become part of, is this a part of our society as well? It's going to creep in also as part of the economy because it's a lot cheaper to, you know, kill someone off than it is to keep treating them, right? If their situation seems hopeless. So I was going back to the pharmacists who all of a sudden they feel as though they've done something heroic, they've gone against their basic instinct of not providing something that will terminate the patient's life. And they kind of need a pat, they feel like they need a pat on the back, you know, that they've done this terrific act of heroism. And it's a twisted view of reality, you know.
Do you think that move towards heroism is subconsciously they try to bring that out of themselves to get a pat on the back that they know they don't deserve, but it might somehow take away that yuck factor?
I think it's probably a way of assuaging their conscience. I said earlier, everyone has one. Everyone has this ability to dialogue with oneself and think about what they've just done. And also there's people who do participate and then they never want to do it again, you know, because they just like, I can't do that, you know. Why can't they do it? They don't know even why they can't. They just can't.
So this was all basically back in 2009. So for the last 10 years, you made your statements, your studies and so on. Mm-hmm. And then How does it either affect your life, or how do you stay involved and so on, for better or for worse?
Okay. So what I've done since the very beginning, I would say starting in the year 2000 to now we're at 2019, believe it or not, is you would have thought that this was a crazy thing to do, but I became sort of a public figure in a sense. I wanted the public, I wanted to be out there. It was a means of actually protecting myself as well, because I thought if I'm out there, it's known. The college knows my stances.
Yeah, right.
I debated, you know, on television. So things are known out there. And since then, I've kept, I wouldn't say a high profile. Maybe less so because, you know, opportunities have not arisen. But also, I haven't been seeking it necessarily. I think we've accomplished a lot since the youth, well, we've gone backwards in having youth-assisted suicide, but we've accomplished a lot in the sense of bringing awareness out there. And the laws still are not perfect, but they're better than the policies, sorry, the college policies are better than they used to be, for sure.
Yeah.
There's also a greater awareness. And for myself personally, I was lucky enough to have an understanding boss who allowed me to, I was not a business owner. I've never been a business owner, but I've practiced in the community setting for most of my career. I started out in hospital pharmacy for my first 8 years of the career, and then moved on to community drugstore, you know, practice. And you'd think that that would be incompatible with all the stuff I've been doing. Yet, if anything, you know, there's only positive things that have come out of my work. And I've also done a lot of writing. I write for the Canadian Healthcare Network, where I write on various topics. They're business ethic. Sorry, not just business. Sorry, not just ethical, but controversial issues, but also just business topics. And yeah, I just feel that there needs to be a place for pharmacists to talk about these more meaty issues. And sometimes because of the work I've done, I've had calls or emails from pharmacists from across the country, young pharmacists, you know, just graduated, because they want advice how to deal with an employer, for example. And there's, you know, where you need to have a good lawyer as well. You need to have a lawyer. Because these issues are employment issues. And this is where pharmacists, we tend to be quite afraid of speaking out. In fact, when I was lobbying the college, I was taken out to dinner by one of the college members. And she said to me, you know, I said, why do you have so many rules and regulations, you know, and why the ethics, the code of ethics spells everything out. Like, it doesn't make sense. You have to leave room for some thought, right? You have to. And she says, no, it's because, you know, pharmacists like to have everything spelled out. You know, they call us and say, what do I do in this situation? What do I do in that one?
Yes.
And so, well, yeah, but we have a mind, you know, we're persons with minds, you know, and so.
Yeah, pharmacists are rule followers in general.
Yeah, right? So it's good to have rules. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but we can't have more rules than the Catholic Church, you know. Even there, you know, as a Roman Catholic, you know, I know that the church allows for freedom of conscience, you know. So,
well, and not only do they allow for it, the informed conscience takes precedence over any other thing that points to morality. The informed conscience is primary. Then all of that. I think the key, though, is that a lot of times people don't choose an informed conscience. They're really looking at sometimes their, well, either uninformed conscience or enough information just to maybe make a decision that they think might be best for them.
Exactly. So their reason, they have to examine the reasons for their actions as well, right?
Yeah.
And I think we all need to do that.
Christina, let me ask this. So I own my pharmacy. I've made a choice not to sell a lot of stuff. I don't sell real expensive cancer medicines that are going to go outdated. I don't sell magazines in my store. I don't sell contraceptives in my store. It's my store. It's my choice. I sell what I want to sell in my store.
Yes.
What if somebody were to work for me and their conscience was that they don't want to sell anti-anxiety tablets because they say that the Bible says that we should not worry, that we should depend on God for our daily bread and not worry about tomorrow. What if that person's conscience said that they don't want to sell the Xanax and these kind of medicines? Do I have protection against that? Because does conscience only go to life and death issues, or do I have to worry about that as a business person?
That's a very, very good point. Yes, as a business person, you should worry, not worry, but you should be concerned, right? We can't, how can I say? Look, as employees, you know, we have to respect also the business aspect. We can't do things. Well, as an example, we shouldn't be preaching to patients. That's one of the things that, you know, is always brought up. Like, you shouldn't be preaching to patients.
Yeah.
We shouldn't make ourselves obnoxious. In the case you mentioned of anti-anxiety pills, yeah, there's not just the Bible, but there's a lot of psychiatrists now saying that, you know,
sure.
People end up getting addicted to a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. You can think of antidepressants. I've read so many good books about written by psychiatrists who are concerned about some of the side effects, and patients are not being forewarned about these. So,
yes.
I mean, I would take this employee aside and say, look, you know, in this is not a life and death situation. The patient... We should be telling the patient. The patient has a right to be informed of all options and of the possible side effects and the possible problems with these medications. I have a friend who refused, for example, to give out cholesterol pills because she was saying it was ruining people's hormones and and the guidelines were way too low. And so she just didn't want to dispense Lipitor or anything related to that.
Interesting.
And, so what do you do in a case like that? You know, it's not a life and death situation, although you could say, well, the patient's not getting his cholesterol. He might end up having blocked arteries and die of a heart attack.
Right.
An argument could be made for the opposite, you know, that he could end up with dementia because now it's, they're looking at studies showing that these drugs can do more harm than good.
And he might die by accidentally lighting the house on fire or something like that. All right, so what do you do as an owner then? Is there any protection for me as an owner if someone like me comes in as an employee and says, I'm not going to do cholesterol, I'm not going to do estrogen because I don't agree with the way that they make this drug or how it treats the women, and I'm not going to do X, Y, and Z. So is there protection for the business person in those cases?
Yes. I mean, as a business person, you have to accommodate to the level of undue hardship. But these are pharmacological issues that you're talking about now. Are they conscience issue? Is it a conscience? It's it's not a religious issue as such. I mean, you can't say that, you know, in the Bible it says that you mustn't dispense anxiolytics. It does say trust in God. So as a business owner, you do have to speak to your employees, know their thoughts on these things, and then you do have to set down some guidelines.
I can see that if I decided to work for an abortion clinic and all of a sudden I said I'm not going to answer the phone anymore, but I'm the secretary there, I can see, you know, it just seems like some things that the boss has the business should have an ability to say that you're not doing, you know, you're not doing your job either. So it's a tough one.
It's a tough one. I think... our decisions need to be evidence-based, you know, so, and also, again, taking into account that the patient is also a decision maker, right? So in this case, you're giving something to the patient, but your action is not producing the effect of killing anyone. Or is not
okay, but okay. So, but is that written in the conscience law about killing someone? Because we can say that birth control's in and of themselves, the mechanism of action talks about decreasing the lining of the uterus, which reduces the likelihood of implantation. So we can be talking about this. Is that anywhere, though, in the conscience clause to protect the business to say that it has to be a direct life and death matter? Or is it just, doesn't it get that deep?
No, it doesn't get that deep.
But maybe it should.
So that's, maybe it should. Yeah, I'm going to play devil's advocate there with birth control, because as you know, we call it birth control, but it's often used for many purposes.
Yeah.
So, I may disagree with the purposes. I think sometimes, it's used as a band-aid solution for women's problems that are not looked at. We don't look at the root cause and try to treat that. We just put a band-aid solution to a lot of things. So the birth control pill for me is one of those, it's a band-aid solution. It can potentially, thin the line of the uterus and prevent implantation, but I have no control over what that woman is going to do with her body, right? So she may or may not go out and have sex.
I'm going to play devil's advocate back and say that is the indication, it's indicated
right
for that. And so somebody might come in and also buy some other drugs that are used to clear out an abortion after it's been aborted and so on. But those drugs, I would play devil's advocate and say those are not indicated for that. But the birth control, number one, it's indicated for that. And also, it's a mechanism of action for that indication. So I would say if you're looking for something in black and white, yes, it can be used for other reasons, but in black and white, I would argue that's both the indication and the mechanism of action. So I would say that's one that I would put higher on the list of a possible conscience objection.
Yes.
It's tricky, though.
It is tricky.
Here you and I are sitting here, and we're both on the same side of this, but you can see that even those on the same side can say, where does it fall in line? So it's tough.
I mean, I think ideally, a pharmacist who has any kind of objection to anything, it can be, like you said, anxiolytics, it can be antidepressants, it can be birth control, it can be
cholesterol, whatever.
Ideally, they shouldn't place themselves in a situation where they are the sole pharmacist. It would be much easier for them if I say this, I speak from experience. I was lucky enough to, for almost 20 years, to work in a pharmacy where, we were at least three pharmacists in one shift. Now, when I became manager of that store in 2012, which I did from 2012 to December 2018, I was able to set a few more, there was more of a leeway for me to set some rules as to what we carried and didn't carry. And I negotiated with my boss the ability of not carrying Plan B or the morning after pill. Yeah. That was back in 2016, which was really cool. And so we were able to negotiate some things. And I think that's where you were saying, well, you're as a business owner, you need to talk to that employee and negotiate and see how far can the business accommodate this, or does it make sense to accommodate this? Does it make sense at all? I mean, anxiolytics, again, it's not, in fact, not giving it to someone who needs them can jeopardize the patient's health, right? So, and the whole topic I believe in the sanctity of life from the moment of conception to natural death, that's as a Roman Catholic, and I don't go back on that. But obviously there's degrees of evil, right?
Right.
So for me, birth control, it's a certain degree, but I wouldn't put it on the same. If you put it on a scale, euthanasia assisted suicide for me is more horrendous. You have to think about, sometimes I stop and I think about, why is it that pharmacy became the gatekeeper of birth control to begin with? Because if you think about it, it doesn't need a pharmacist for dispensing. And you can have it in a machine for all I care. I, you know, certainly, you, you don't, I know many pharmacists would disagree with me on this. They see it as a therapeutic option. But however, if you read the side effects, which, you know, are, you know, if you roll out all of the side effects in that little pamphlet, you go, whoa, you know, is this doing women more harm than good? And I think we've become so accustomed to just dispensing that we no longer even, we mindlessly dispense. The drug company is happy that we are mindlessly dispensing. And I've actually written about the effects of birth control on even our water system and our, everyone's talking about the ecology, you know, that's another topic for another show.
It's tricky though, because once you go down that road, then you can look at almost every drug of the negative effects that it's having.
I think
both sides owe it to each other, and I see it from both angles, because at one point I was an employee of my dad, who's since passed, but I think both sides owe it to each other to speak up, and I think that it's tricky.
I think you've just hit the nail on the head. I think there needs to be the ability and opportunity to dialogue.
I don't think there's easy answers necessarily. It's not clean. It's not clean by any means, but I think that the conversation has to be, at minimum, the conversation has to be had.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where, I think that by even just having this opportunity to speak on this podcast, you know, it gives us a chance to air out some issues that I think a lot of people may be thinking about, but not able to put in words, right, to articulate. And by articulating some of these thoughts, you know, we're actually helping, I think, I hope.
And I agree, Christina. And I think one thing it helps people to do is know that there's even a language out there. You know, years ago, I always thought that I never felt right going into the pharmacy. I would get like butterflies and stuff. And I never knew that that language existed about nervousness and anxiety and you know, this and that. And just being able to know that the language is out there with the words like maleficence, and just knowing that there's a language out there helps people to name some of those feelings. And sometimes we can't name them even too much better than just calling it the yuck factor, but there is a language, and people can and should be talking about it.
Again, you hit the nail on the head. You know, just open up conversation. Don't be afraid of dialoguing with people who disagree with you. You know, I find it's the most enriching thing ever. Like, I have friends who don't see eye to eye with me on these issues at all, but you know, the fact that we're able to carry on a conversation and try to see each other's point of view.
Right.
You know, and frankly, sometimes we're too caught up with ideology and we're afraid, because what are people going to think, you know? So, you know, a big corporation, you know, takes over a little independent, and all of a sudden now, you know, it becomes a problem. Now, you know, you're no longer able to have accommodation because, you know, it becomes a political issue for them, or it becomes an ideological. And it's unfortunate, because where there's a will, there's a way. There's a way to accommodate people who dissent from the norm. And I'm not talking about wacko ideas. I'm talking about, in my case, it's any drug that does not respect life from the moment of conception to natural death. I mean, yeah, you could also include in the middle of that, well, anxiolytics or whatever. I don't know.
It's hard to say.
That's opening up a can of worms a little bit.
It's hard to say, but the conversation is good.
Yeah, the conversation is good. And again, going back to other medication, I think as pharmacists, not I think, I know as pharmacists, we are the primary educators of the patient on drug therapy. Unfortunately, that's been taken over a little bit by the self-interest of drug companies, who are now doing direct to patient consumer marketing, and which should never have happened.
Right.
And sometimes the doctors are in on it too, because they have a cut, right? So they're getting some compensation from the companies. So not all doctors, but some. So the pharmacist really has to remain neutral in terms of of therapy on anxiolytics, antidepressants, even though maybe you're not pro some of these things.
And for the record, I don't have a problem myself with the anti-anxiety or depressants.
No,
that was just a point I was making. And I think you'd have to be, and I think that even though I was playing devil's advocate about those, I think that life and death is certainly...
That's more clear-cut.
That's more clear-cut. And I think it has to be more clear-cut for anybody. I mean, you look at some of the worst of the worst, you know, serial killers or whatever, and there's not much debate around whether they're going to have potatoes or oatmeal, but certainly the conversation when it comes down to a life conversation of whether they're going to be put to death or not, that gets people talking. And so even though I was playing devil's advocate, certainly the life-death issue is the primary discussion point, it seems.
Yes. And when you talk about capital punishment, I mean, that, you know, there's a lot of people out there, pharmacists included, who would not want to prepare drugs for execution because, well, for many reasons. One of them might be that, you know, sometimes mistakes are made. So, or they just think, they just don't believe in execution. They believe in trying to rehabilitate the prisoner. So, again,
I always like to think that that we're doing, you and I, looking at conscience, are doing the job of everybody, because at some point it's going to come up in someone's life, even though you don't know when it's going to come. There's all kinds of stuff that's coming down the road that, as we talked about with someone's own grandma, facing whether they should call their life short because of insurance, you know, rebates or whatever.
Absolutely. And I'd like to just mention that there's actually two Canadian provinces that have, I would say, the ideal conscience clause. And I'm going to just read it because it's so amazing. Newfoundland and Labrador, for example, they state that accommodation for the objector must be provided by management, which is amazing that they even state that. And then it's management that develops a means to ensure the medication or services are provided. So it's not the objector, him or herself, that's ensuring this, right? So I think that's the key, that you don't force the objector to be the one doing the referral or the provision, but that someone else takes over that role. In my case, it was my pharmacy assistant who would screen the prescriptions and not give me the ones I wasn't going to fill. So Newfoundland, Labrador, and also Nova Scotia are the two that that have that kind of a statement in there. And I think that's really important and respectful.
Yeah, that makes a lot of, it makes a lot of sense. Well, Christina, it was a pleasure having you on. We could go on forever, but I think this gave people enough to kind of whet their appetite a little
bit. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for having me on, Mike. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Christina. You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.